From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Rescue crews are continuing their search today for three sailors missing in the Philippine Sea after yesterday's crash of a U.S. Navy transport plane. Eight sailors survived and were rescued from the water shortly after the crash, but this will be a difficult holiday for the families of the missing. And it's a reminder this Thanksgiving that thousands of American soldiers are separated from their loved ones while serving and sacrificing overseas. Soldiers like Tori Lynch, an Army captain based in Baghdad, Iraq. She's part of the coalition of American troops in Iraq and Syria supporting the fight against the Islamic State. Her husband, Larry Lynch, is back home in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He's looking after their three small children, and he's also an Army staff sergeant. We brought them together for a little bit of a reunion. Tori, Larry, welcome to you both. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Well, sure. We're glad you're here. And Tori, you're thousands of miles away from home right now. How are you feeling about missing Thanksgiving?
Of course, it's always sad to be away from the family and not actually physically being there. But Larry and I have experienced this before. He was gone to Korea for a year. I guess it's like tag teaming. So it's always one of those bittersweet moments where we just try to communicate, video chat, to keep each other included in the day.
Well, I want to talk about the technology, because in past wars in Vietnam and before that, you could go many, many weeks or months without hearing from a loved one. I think even in the first Iraq war, it was probably very different. What about now? How do families who are serving abroad, how do they connect with home?
Yeah, I mean, of course, now it's a whole lot better with the technology we have now. There's so many different avenues to communicate with, and that's what we try to utilize. Everybody has some type of app on their phone, so we don't let a day go past to where we don't talk to each other or talk to the kids or our family. So we take advantage of the technology we have today.
Really, you get the kids up in your lap, and they look at mom on the video camera all the way in Baghdad?
Yeah, I do that a lot, of course. And when they're in my lap, they're kind of busy. So it may say a couple words to mom and then go back to playing. And I'll send a lot of pictures as well.
Well, Larry, you know what it's like to be on the other side. As Tori mentioned, you served in Korea over the holidays and you've been separated before. But what's it like for you to be at home taking care of the kids while she's away?
Oh, of course, it's a little bit bittersweet. It's good to see their faces in the flesh and see them in person. So, of course, they're excited to see me. But I guess the bitter portion of it is when they ask for their mom. And I know at the age that they're at right now, when I explain to them, like, hey, she'll be back shortly, they'll kind of, you know, take what I said and kind of shrug it off. And be like, okay, well, I'm going to go to the next event and I'm going to ask for her again in the next 10 minutes. So, I mean, we're getting through it. A little rough, of course. Anybody would love for everybody to be home, but the children understand what mom has to do.
They do. You know? They understand, you think.
Yeah.
Do you, in the back of your mind, as you're taking care of the kids and you're there at home without your wife and they're there without their mother, does your mind ever wander to a worst-case scenario where she's in a very dangerous part of the world? She's helping fight terrorism in two very unsettled places, Iraq and Syria. Do you sometimes worry about if something were to happen to her?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the reality of it, you know, and that's just, I guess, the soldier portion of both of us being in the military. I think about that, but of course, I'm always optimistic, too. I know, like, she's going to do whatever she can to come home. But of course, in the reality of it, like, we already, you know, have preparations for a worst case scenario, God forbid. But, you know, I never put that in our children's heads. Like, I never even give them a hint. As this, she's like in a very, very dangerous situation because I don't want them to worry too much. But I understand they know that as well. So, but I think about it at times. You know, it's the reality of it. But I mean, I'm also very optimistic and I know she'll come back home.
Tori, what do you think about that? It's interesting because your situation is the reverse of what we're so used to in this country, where you are the mother who is serving abroad in a war zone and Larry is the father back at home with the kids. Do you think about that, the danger that you're in, that you've potentially put your family in?
I do, but we always are thinking positive and always, you know, being aware of my situation and just knowing, like, you know, at one second, you know, things can change and life, our whole lives can change. But, like, we've talked to our kids about it, and even though, like Larry said, we don't bring it up and talk to them about it, we did have a sit down and we did talk to them about it. But as a mother, of course, I want to be a part of every day, like everything. So I try to shop online when I can. I'm sure I'm micromanaging Larry at this point, but he's so patient with me. So he's just like, okay, babe, all right, got it. But
you think he's doing a good job?
He is doing an awesome job, and we have a great support system. My parents are there. My parents, they're pastors of church, so we have a very big community of help. It really takes a village, and we are really stretching our village out for this year, but we're so appreciative of everyone.
Well, you know, I ask you that question about the danger, because if you look at what the U.S. government has recorded over the past year, the Department of Defense says that 31 service members died in action overseas this year. For the first time in 6 years, the number of American troops killed has increased over the previous year. And so that's why I ask you that question. And I want to also ask you, do you sometimes feel that America has forgotten that people like you are serving overseas and are at risk?
In a sense, because of everything that's going on in America right now, it's easy to forget that there's troops over here fighting on a day-to-day basis, risking their lives. It is forgotten about. And that's one of the things that I make sure I talk to my troops about, you know, reaching out to your friends, keeping up with your family back home. Because sometimes we get so busy here that we don't reach back and let them know, like, hey, I'm still here. So us making that advance and reaching back to our families and friends and just letting them know, like, hey, I'm okay. In case you didn't, you know, ask about me, I'm still okay over here.
Really?
Right.
Yeah, so time flies, but it goes slow, if that makes sense. So, yeah, just making sure they're staying up on it, because I'm on it. I have a calendar. I'm tracking our birthdays, anniversaries there. So just so that, you know, they don't feel forgotten about, even though, you know, a lot of it's not being said about it.
Well, Larry, you are stateside. Do you feel the same way, that the sacrifice that service members are making right now is not being recognized by Americans?
Oh, yes. I think it's been like that for quite some time. I mean, besides your Veterans Day or your Memorial Day, besides those holidays that are usually observed, you hear very little about how troops are doing over there. You may see a couple of things on the news and that are usually dangerous situations, but a lot of things that are publicized with troops being overseas and in the danger zones not really being displayed as it should be. And of course, in times like this during the holiday, I see certain things about, you know, suicide rates and stuff like that. But this is the time when soldiers really need to be reached out to. I guess they say what the strongest ones are the ones that you usually have to worry about. And so soldiers are usually figured as strong. So when they worry about protecting the nation, nobody's really worried about how they're doing. So,
yeah. How are your colleagues and your peers and even the both of you handling conversations at home that we've been having? You know, for instance, we're having fights over whether or not sports stars should be kneeling during the national anthem. I mean, how is that going over?
Well, honestly, we fight for that right, and we protect that right to have people choose whichever they want to do. And so we take pride in the fact that they choose to kneel or they choose to stand, and that decision and that we actually give them the opportunity to have that.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately it. My colleagues and the people that I serve with, we try to leave the political stance of it. We leave it be. We focus on our mission at hand. We focus on what we have to do. And we know why we're fighting. We know why we serve. So usually we see the political stances going on, and we make sure we focus on the mission. That's a huge distraction.
Yeah. Well, look, it's Thanksgiving, so I want to ask you, before we go, tell me something that you're thankful for.
I'm definitely thankful for Tori, and thankful for the courage that she took to, you know, go over and serve the great nation that we have. I'm thankful for her all the time, every day. So I just wouldn't pinpoint Thanksgiving for that. And then we express to each other how much we're appreciative of each other and how much we're thankful for the kids and our family. So, I mean, little things like, hey, you took the trash out, thanks, while she was here. You know what I mean?
I agree. We do show words of affirmation to each other that we're very grateful for our kids and our family and their accomplishments. I definitely wouldn't be here without them because I wouldn't have a peace of mind. So I appreciate them holding it down while I'm here.
That's Army Captain Tori Lynch serving in Baghdad. And her husband, Army Staff Sergeant Larry Lynch, he is in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where they live. Thank you so much to you both. Happy Thanksgiving, and appreciate your service.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for having us. We appreciate it. Happy Thanksgiving.
Sounds from today's Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, a 91-year-old tradition in New York City and the world's largest parade. The 2.6-mile route also has a new distinction this year. It's being called the most carefully surveilled stretch of pavement in the country's history, with extensive security in place less than a month after a man pledging allegiance to the Islamic State drove a truck into a crowded bike path. He killed 8 people and injured 11 others in Lower Manhattan. Here's New York Police Department Chief of Patrol Terrence Monahan.
You can expect to see numerous sand trucks, block of vehicles protecting the entire venues. You will see heavy weapon teams deployed at both the balloons and during the parade. They'll be all over the parade route. We will have observation teams located at various locations along the route also. You will see our vaporweight dogs and other canine dogs on both the balloons and during the route. We will have mounted officers assigned. We will have teams assigned with our radiation detective devices. We will have aviation assigned to both venues, a ship assigned to each one of the venues to make sure everything check on rooftops.
But the precautions did not deter the crowds. An estimated 3.5 million people came out to watch the parade. Here's Heather Powell, a first-time spectator who traveled from Nashville to watch the spectacle with her family.
We headed out about 5:30 this morning, I guess, and we've been here since about 6:45 to stake out our spot. We've got a great set of seats right at 73rd and Central Park West, so we've got a great view right at the beginning of the parade.
The parade included 17 giant balloon floats, including the Grinch from Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Olaf from Frozen. Rounding out the entertainment, 1,100 cheerleaders and dancers, 1,000 clowns, 12 marching bands, and 6 performing groups, a total of 8,000 marchers in all. An American tradition that many of us remember since our childhood, today in New York. And now our own Thanksgiving tradition. Some of our listeners might remember a pilgrimage that Robin made to Vermont to see the annual migration of the snow geese with her uncle Lachlan McLachlan Field. At the time of her visit, Uncle Locke, as Robin called him, was 88 and starting his battle with Alzheimer's. He died just before Thanksgiving 2004 at the age of 91. Robin's story has touched many listeners over the years.
The snow geese, thousands of them, touch down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcards. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went.
Uncle Locke?
Yo!
Hi!
Hey, yo!
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLachlan Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen it. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much.
Sit around. Vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
She's a pro. What, in case someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here?
I got it.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
So, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. Been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all alone, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, it's right on the big flyway from north to south. So they flock in there. I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe. But no guarantee this time that they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they aren't going to hang around.
I know.
They go through sometimes in by the thousands. I saw one day I walked out the backyard. And snow geese are going by. Yeah. They were low, very, very, very low, and they're way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field length.
Really?
Yeah. So I got big. I watched this big chain going. It's up over the top of the trees, down and down and down. Never seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming. All honking away. Sound exactly like that, if you want to know.
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, we just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
There's a lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay.
Right. There they go. See them?
Yep. All right, now
look at the cars here.
I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese.
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
We're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look for one Ross's goose. But it's also...
Name that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S.
Ross's.
R-O-S-S apostrophe S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's goose.
Huh? Yeah.
Small. They're out here.
Yeah, I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Also, if you look right over the parking lot here, is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is. The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh my gosh! Hundreds, thousands of them! Uncle Locke, look! Thousands!
Around! Yeah.
Something. Here they come.
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
One great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know, I mean, that's just, I live for that every fall.
I bet I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back And it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see. And tree height. As far south as you see.
Okay. We're getting frozen.
That's right.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice. Yeah, I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. They'll be gone. When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
Yeah. Okay. When you want to get something to eat?
You want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
A return visit to the Snow Geese of Vermont with my late uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, who passed away in 2004 at the age of 91. I think of him often, especially when I see a line of geese stretched across the sky.
A thin white line, as far as you can see, and tree height. Just one long column of them. When they go, it's like click, turning the light off. They're gone.
You're listening to Here and Now. Wells Fargo was fined $185 million. The CEO resigned, and it's been struggling ever since. Emily Glazer covers banks for the Wall Street Journal. And Emily, how's Wells Fargo doing today?
Not so great. You mentioned some of the things that have happened over the last year or so, and the bank is continuing to deal with a slew of regulations. Federal investigations are going on. State investigations are going on. It's had other settlements tallying tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, we're keeping an eye out for more to come. So there are still a lot of problems ahead.
What about these fake accounts? More than 3 million of them. What's going on with those?
So there have been up to 3.5 million potentially unauthorized accounts using fictitious or unauthorized customer information. So this is no small potatoes. The bank has gone through major management changes. They've changed the way that branch employees can open or close accounts, and they're trying to regain trust. Huge marketing campaign. At the same time, even though they've made all of these changes, for many customers, it's not enough and they don't trust Wells Fargo. But because it's so difficult to move your bank accounts, think about everything that we've set up, you know, online bill pay, you know, even just getting your paycheck. It is sort of a pain for people to move their accounts. So Wells Fargo has the stickiness of banking in their favor, even if they've lost customers' trust.
Well, Warren Buffett is an investor in the company. And this October, he said that he still had faith in Wells Fargo, but it does look like Berkshire Hathaway is pulling back a little bit on its investment. How are investors feeling about Wells Fargo?
You'd be surprised. You'd think that they would be very fed up that more than a year has passed and the bank has not just been dealing with the retail sales practices problems, but there are other major issues that have arisen in its mortgage business, in its auto lending business, and more recently in its investment bank. But investors for now are saying, look, you know, they've changed management. Let's give Timothy Sloan, the new CEO, he's been in the job for about a year, a little bit more time. He's trying to spot all of the problems and clean what was the mistakes from past management. However, there was a Warren Buffett quote that he said on CNBC several months ago that I thought really resonated, which is that once you find one cockroach, there are usually more around.
Wow, right. And you had mentioned, Emily, this idea of regulation, that Wells Fargo was getting hit hard by regulators. What does the future look like for them in that department? They're operating under a Trump administration and a Republican Congress that has tried to roll back banking regulations.
It's really interesting to look at Wells Fargo under this new administration. We've been waiting for a number of Department of Justice settlements for a bunch of different banks for different reasons, and a lot of them are taking much longer than anyone anticipated, especially settlements having to do with residential mortgage-backed securities, which is a technical way of referring to the financial crisis.
Yeah.
So Wells Fargo, in fact, we're expecting them to get a settlement that is more than $1 billion that they're going to have to pay to the Justice Department. And we have all these other investigations that are playing out, and some of them are likely to turn into settlements as well. But because the Trump administration has been taking more time than past administrations in appointing people to different key regulatory posts, what we're hearing from our reporting is that it's taking a longer time for some of these settlements to play out with different banks.
Emily Glazer, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She covers banks there. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
This year, three hurricanes in quick succession slammed into parts of Texas, Florida, and the Caribbean. The residents of Île de Jean Charles in southern Louisiana were spared. And that is a good thing, because the next hurricane that hits the island could be its last. The town is home to a community of Native Americans that is sinking into the water. And the state is moving the island's 29 households to higher ground. I visited the Louisiana coast this summer, and we're going to revisit this story about some of America's first climate refugees. Since the middle of the last century, more than 90% of Île de Jean Charles has just dissolved into the bayou, and the people who still live here are barely clinging to what's left.
Hi, Rooster.
Rooster Falgo is working under the hot sun. He's outside his home, stooped over an ancient-looking lawnmower. With spare parts and tools around his feet, he says he doesn't want to leave.
I don't believe I got that much left.
You don't think you have that much left, so you just want to stick around?
81 left, you know. 81 years old, huh? So,
You're 81 years old.
Yeah, I'm 82, so...
But Rooster's wife, Rita, is ready.
It's totally different, from when I grew up.
What's the biggest difference?
The water.
Rita Falgo says life here is becoming increasingly isolated. Last year, the state of Louisiana announced a $48 million grant from the federal government to resettle members of the island's Biloxi, Chitimacha, Choctaw tribe. The state predicts sea level rise and rampant coastal erosion will make Île de Jean Charles unlivable in the coming years. The road that connects it to the outside world is already crumbling into the water.
Across there, we could walk way back there where you see the water.
I see a lot of water way back there. So you're just pointing off into the distance. I see maybe is that an oil well right there?
Past that.
You're saying that used to be all dry land?
Dry land. Mm-hmm. The oil companies started digging canals, and anyway, erosion. Erosion like back there. The island is going under, and the whole thing's going to be underwater soon. Like another hurricane, and we're gone. If we have another one like Rita or Gustav, that's going to be it.
But it's not even just the hurricanes. It's like trying to cross that road that leads to the island. There was water on that when I crossed over today.
Yeah, and you see, my granddaughter used to live with me all the time, but she moved. It was too far from doctors and hospital. She's a diabetic. She couldn't stay here. She had to go. It was bad. And my husband, worried about him, see if he gets sick. And the road's flooded, but we're going to.
You want to get out of here as soon as you possibly can.
Yes.
Because you feel like the clock is ticking.
It is.
And it's not hard to see why she feels this sense of pending disaster. On a perfect blue sky day, I had to drive my car through a street flooded with ankle-deep water to meet one of the island's residents. Soon, the people who live here will be among the first climate refugees in America. But what happens to their culture and their way of life? Families grew up here sustaining themselves on the land that's given way to this.
People could hunt and trap. There were fruit trees, grapefruit, strawberries, tomatoes, anything you could grow.
Heather Stone is an oral historian at the University of Louisiana Lafayette, who's been speaking to people here about what they've lost and what they're about to lose. We met on top of the island's levee with a clear view of the water on the other side.
There was cattle on the island.
What happened?
A lot of different things. So about 100 years ago, when the Mississippi upriver, they started using levees and dams up there, it affected the drainage that came here. So there was no sediments to rebuild after storms. Mm-hmm. So the island started shrinking then. And then the storms would come and take chunks away.
In a way, it's beautiful. It's green, the water, the clouds, the sky, the fresh breeze coming off.
But this is why people want to stay.
This place is in a crisis.
Yes. The peaceful feeling that you get here is a sense of place that you can't just go and find somewhere else. And it's in crisis because until the 1950s, the only way you could get here was by piro, which is a little canoe that's carved out of cypress. And you can't even get you don't even see any cypress trees that are alive here anymore.
All those dead trees that we can see right here on the inside of the levee are dead, and that's because of salt water.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, the government has given this money mm-hmm. to move people out of this community. You're an oral historian. You talk mm-hmm. to people about this very thing, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. How do they feel about this idea of leaving this spot?
You know, this is a Native American community, the Biloxi, Chittimacha, Choctaw. And they've been here since the 1800s. During the Indian Removal Act, they moved here to get away from being moved to Oklahoma and further west and hid here and found and remade themselves here. So they were from internally in the U.S. where they did not fish, they did not shrimp, they did not do any of that. They came here and made a whole life for themselves. And generations have gone by and they've made it work. And now they will never be able to have cattle again, or the water's not going to be clean enough for them to grow on the ground. And if you came into my neighborhood, which haven't even been there more than 10 years, and said, I'm sorry, but it's not cost effective to save this neighborhood, I'd be like, what are you talking about?
There's just not enough people here mm-hmm. to build the infrastructure that would protect it, essentially. It's not New Orleans.
No.
We understand that it's a really tragic set of circumstances that, you know, I think anybody would be emotional about.
Matthew Sanders works for the state's Office of Community Development, the agency responsible for resettling the island. Sanders says the move is voluntary. No one will be forced to leave. He says of the island's 29 households, all but three agree it's time to go.
As we build out a new community and we move them off the island, we want them to maintain continued access to the island and allow them to use it for recreational, cultural purposes. Until which time it goes underwater and there's no longer any access to it. And so we've talked about that in terms of a long goodbye.
And that goodbye will be here soon. The state has identified three potential tracts of nearby land on higher ground. Sanders says they're looking for a place that's similar culturally and historically to the home the islanders are leaving. The new houses will be raised up to protect against flooding. Construction could start next year.
I don't know that there's a comparable example of trying to pick up a community as a whole and move it wholesale. You know, there's not really a blueprint here that we can follow. So, I mean, part of what we're trying to do here is really create a model that can be scaled and replicated in other places. And so it's a learning opportunity.
I mean, there's no blueprint, but you may be making one and you may have to use it again, judging by how things are going down there.
Well, I think not only may we have to use it again, but we're certainly going to have to use it again. And so we understand in Louisiana that despite all of our coastal restoration efforts, despite all of our structural protection efforts, you know, we're going to lose land over time and we're going to incur a higher degree of flood risk. And, you know, we have communities that are just from a physical and environmental standpoint not going to be able to survive over the decades to come. And so you know, we can either sit around and wait for that degradation to happen over time or in an instant through a significant disaster event, or we can be proactive and work with those communities today and find some financially sustainable model by which we can pick people up and move them as a group.
There is an eerie sense of finality to all this.
Did he just go in?
For some people on the island, this is happening at the end of a long life. Wenceslas and Denicia Billiot are in their 90s and frail. They spend their afternoons on an elevated porch overlooking the levee, occasionally slipping into the French they grew up learning on the bayou.
I don't know if I want to move. I'm be gone before the thing is not finished. Yeah, I'm 92. That's the old James Placer.
But Denicia's husband says they will go. Ile de Jean Charles has changed too much.
I'm on his display. You see, when I was a boy, they had a marsh in there. They didn't have no water like that. You can go put a trap, get some muskrat, raccoon, everything they had those days. But no more. Now everything is gone.
That story first aired in June, and there's news about Denicia and Wenceslas. They're doing great. They're going to celebrate their 70th wedding anniversary on December 23rd. He doesn't know how much time he has left, but the man we're going to meet next from Springfield, Massachusetts, is sick, and he's preparing for the end. As he waits, he's finding new ways to make a difference. Erica Lance from member station WBUR's Kind World podcast has the story.
44-year-old Bob Sharland never had much free time. Auto mechanic by day, bouncer by night, single dad all the time. He was still the kind of guy who became a leader for his daughter's Girl Scout troop, who learned sign language so he could teach an automotive class to deaf students. He was always going. Then, about 8 months ago, he noticed something was off.
My right hand was shaking all the time. My speech was going off. I was forgetting more and more.
Sharland thought it might have something to do with the concussions he'd gotten as a bouncer. Like the time a guy he kicked out of the bar hit him in the head with a baseball bat.
There was another time I left the bar where I got jumped by a couple of guys outside, and they left a pair of pliers in my head.
Doctors were able to remove the pliers. They've been keeping an eye on his brain for a while and can see excessive brain atrophy. Now, Sharland says, they told him he probably had a degenerative brain disease, possibly chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, the same disease that you've heard about affecting football players.
My brain looks like it's somebody in his 80s, almost 90 years old. And the reality is, once the brain dies, the body dies.
Doctors didn't know how long Sharland had to live, but the diagnosis set him in motion.
I don't even think I was fully out the door of the doctor's office, and I called my lawyer. I said, look, here's the deal.
Sharland got all of his affairs in order, but there was something else on his mind.
I don't want my daughter to see me not being able to take care of myself.
So Sharland went to Vermont to apply for a program called Death with Dignity. It lets people take prescribed medication to end their lives after a doctor okays it and confirms they have less than 6 months to live. Sharland was just starting the application process when he got a call from a school counselor back home in Western Massachusetts. She'd heard that he sometimes fixed old bicycles to give to kids who couldn't afford them, and she wondered if he had any to donate to her students. After the call, Bob had an epiphany.
You know what? I gotta go home. There was no more thought of, I gotta get my death ready. It was, I gotta live.
So Sharland fixed up some tricycles and brought them to the preschool. A local news station put the story on TV, and suddenly requests started coming in. Before long, he found himself giving bikes to kids who were homeless.
They were riding and smiling at each other. Look how fast I can go. These kids are innocent, and they don't deserve this. They deserve something more in life. So if we can take our time and do something as simple as bicycles to change their life, I wasn't going to stop.
Sharland decided he would devote the time he had left to helping kids like them. Every day after work, he starts fixing up bikes and keeps going late into the night. His obsession has grown into a community phenomenon. People call him the bike man, and volunteers come to donate bikes or help build them. 29-year-old Jeremiah Ocasio recruited his whole family to volunteer.
Any free time I get, you know, it's here with Bob.
How long are you going to do this?
Till the end. I mean, I already told Bob. He made me promise him that when he's, you know, gone, that we'll keep it going. And I looked him dead in his eyes and told him that I would. And we'll be giving bikes out till the day I'm gone.
And there's plenty of need. Bob and his crew had already given away hundreds of bikes when they heard about a teenager named Zach Theroux.
My bike's my best friend, in a weird way. One of the only things that really makes me happy is just going out and riding my bike.
Zach is 17, When he was 12, his mother died of a brain aneurysm. Then, not long after that, his dad had to have both of his legs amputated. They lost the house. And now he and his dad live in a cramped hotel room. Every day after school, Zach comes here to a nearby skate park and practices tricks until dark.
It helps me clear my mind. My bike is everything to me. You can be sad with it. It doesn't judge me when I'm riding, singing, being a goof.
A few weeks ago, Zach's bike was stolen. So Bob the Bike Man called up his guys, and they showed up at Zach's door with 30 bikes for him to choose from.
After my bike got stolen, I didn't think there was a lot of good, like a good people out there and stuff. There's a meaning behind that bike. It's just godly almost.
Moments like that motivate Bob Sharland. He barely sleeps, but he's full of energy.
Everything is unknown. So maybe I have 5-10 years. Maybe I don't. I've made a difference while I was here.
In the meantime, Bob says he doesn't want a day to go by without helping someone. Stop by the shop after 5, and chances are you'll find him, garage open, leaning over a bike, working into the night, and dreaming of the kid who will ride it. For Here and Now, I'm Erica Lance.
Hug your family. Erica's story comes to us from the WBUR podcast, Kind World. Here and Now is a production from NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. From all of us to all of you, have a happy Thanksgiving. It's Here and Now.